It's Friday, April 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the Nuclear Security Summit here in Washington focuses on North Korea and the Islamic State. Amnesty International condemns a refugee agreement signed by Turkey and the European Union.
What we're seeing is the construction, first of Fortress Europe, but now Fortress Turkey.
And internationally renowned architect Zaha Hadid dies at the age of 65. It's all ahead. U.S. President Barack Obama's fourth and final nuclear summit is concluding in Washington. I spoke with White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas about the discussions and the concerns of the international community.
While the White House acknowledges that there's a long way to go still in totally being a nuclear-free world, they say progress has been made because at these summits, though there's nothing binding, nations have made commitments. The White House says more than 260 commitments on the part of nations who then come to these summits and then report on the progress they made on these commitments. 75% of them, the White House says, have been followed through on, implemented. And so it's a safer world, the White House says, but not yet safe enough.
Did Mr. Obama talk about the Iran nuclear deal?
That is a discussion today. In fact, on Friday, he met with members of the P5 plus one, the nations who took part in the negotiations. And they spoke again about how important this was in making the world safer. The president also said this does not, you know, excuse what Western officials see as still inappropriate and dangerous behavior on the part of Tehran in parts of the world. But they say this nuclear deal is a good thing. Of course, there's a lot of controversy about that, especially in the Republican-led Congress, whether or not this was a good deal for the U.S. and the world.
On this day, North Korea test-fired another suspected ballistic missile. How much of the talks centered around North Korea?
A lot, really. In discussions that were held on the first day, bilateral and trilateral between the U.S., Japan, China, South Korea, North Korea was front and center. And that Pyongyang test fired is not necessarily a surprise. That's usually the way they operate when they want to capture the world's attention, especially when discussions are being held right now about the need for tough enforcement of these tough new UN sanctions against South Korea after its actions earlier this year, the testing of a nuclear test and then a long-range missiles test. So I think a lot of it has focused on North Korea, a lot of it, I think, on China following through on these tough new sanctions, because that's going to be critical on whether or not this is effective, because so much of what goes in and out of North Korea goes through China first. So China, which has been more reluctant to support sanctions, tougher sanctions, really must follow through for this to work. That's the view here.
Well, and also these talks occur soon after the Brussels terror attacks. What about concerns that radioactive materials might get into the hands of Islamic State militants?
That is a tremendous concern here. There is acknowledgement that it's still a lot of facilities, a lot of nuclear materials, 2,000 metric tons of materials, including highly enriched uranium and separated plutonium, are still out there in different countries, whether in civilian bases or military bases. So, and they're not secure enough. So this is a pressing issue. This is something that the nations must continue to work on going forward. Now, after this administration is over, you know, a new president comes in January. The question is, what will the architecture be for handling nuclear security issues moving ahead?
That's White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas. Well, joining me is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Oh, it's a big day today, April 1st. It was 40 years ago today that Apple was formed. Of course, we now have, everybody seems to have an iPod or an iPhone or an iPad. And in 2004, on April 1st, Gmail, Google's mail service, was started. But today is also April Fool's Day, which is April 1st. I think most people know April 1st is April Fool's Day. And speaking of Gmail, they got in a bit of hot water this morning with April Fools. They usually every year do a little prank or something funny for April Fool's Day, and this year they did something called the mic drop button. And if you hit the mic drop button when you sent an email, it would put in a little gif of a minion from the movie Despicable Me just dropping a microphone, and that would be the end of the message chain. Well, they put it right next to the send button, and that was problematic for a lot of people because they didn't realize that there was a difference. They accidentally would click the send and mic drop button when sending emails to clients or other important people, business contacts, things like that. So there were a lot of unhappy people on social media, so much so that Gmail actually removed this mic drop prank and said, "We apologize. We didn't mean for people to have an issue with it." But social media was in a bit of an uproar this morning as part of that, as this April Fool's Day continues. They're also seeing a lot of just little jokes and things that people are sending out. Some that I really liked. There was one where the Harlem Globetrotters, you know, the trick basketball team, they posed as wax figures in Madame Tussauds wax museum. And then when people come take pictures with them, they would kind of jump out and start dribbling the basketball.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was a fun little video that they posted to social media. And a lot of people talking about something that does not appear to be an April Fool's joke, that Wendy Deng, the ex-wife of Rupert Murdoch, is apparently dating Russian President Vladimir Putin. People saying this sounds like an April Fool's joke, but it allegedly is true. So lots of conversation about that on social media, kind of the gossip, the geopolitics, it kind of all combines into this one story.
Certainly is rather intriguing there. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Italian astronomers say they have observed something never seen before, a fast-spinning pulsar in the nearby Andromeda, or M31, galaxy. Their findings were published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. Pulsars are spinning neutron stars that produce a focused beam of magnetic radiation, which some say resembles a lighthouse beacon. Since pulsars rotate, their light can appear to be pulsating. Neutron stars are the compacted remains of an enormous star that exploded in a supernova. While pulsars and other rotating neutron stars are quite common in our own Milky Way, this marks the first time such an object has been spotted in the Andromeda Galaxy. The astronomers made their discovery as they were reviewing past data from the European Space Agency's XMM Newton Space Telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the architecture world mourns the death of Zaha Hadid. The European Union and Greece will begin sending migrants from the Greek Isles to Turkey on Monday. The deportation plan, which includes Syrians, is part of a deal reached 2 weeks ago between the Turkish government and the EU. The agreement aims to ease Europe's migrant crisis, but human rights advocates and leftists in Europe have protested the deal, saying it arises from xenophobia. In a new report, the London-based human rights group Amnesty International criticized the agreement, saying Ankara has expelled Syrians on an almost daily basis since the beginning of this year. I spoke with Amnesty's Turkey researcher Andrew Gardner in Istanbul and asked him to elaborate on his organization's findings.
Well, these latest returns are really shocking in the inhumanity that we've seen and also the scale of them. It's not the first time we've documented forced returns of Syrian refugees from Turkey, but the scale that we're seeing. What we've seen is we've documented two cases in detail where, in one case, over 100, in the other case, over 200 Syrian men, women, and children were forced from Turkey's bordering Hatay province back into Syria. So what we're receiving from the people on the ground is really consistent reports that these mass returns, they're happening on a regular, even on an almost daily basis for the past 6 to 8 weeks. So potentially it could mean that thousands of Syrian refugees have been forced back into Syria.
Now, what are the conditions for these people like? And do these include women and children?
They certainly include women and children. I mean, the people we've spoke to and the Syrian refugees ourselves who gave testimonies about their family members and indeed people we've spoken to who've been pushed back into Syria and who we spoke to by phone whilst they're actually in camps in Syria, they told us examples of, for example, an 8-month pregnant woman who was forced back into Syria. Three children under the age of 11 who were apprehended in Turkey and sent back to Syria, you know, so are now separated from their parents who remain in Turkey. So the conditions also which people are being sent back to are abysmal. They're mainly in camps close to the Turkish border, camps without running water, without sanitation, where the dangers include reports of kidnappings for ransom. So it's really a situation which is completely unsafe for anyone, let alone small young children or pregnant women.
Why do you believe that this is illegal under international law?
Well, it's clearly illegal under international law. The principle that no one should be forced back to a country where they may face persecution, human rights abuses, is a very well-established principle in international law. It's also a very clear requirement in Turkish law that people shouldn't be sent back. So there's no real debate about whether this is legal or otherwise. It's just simply not just unlawful, but completely immoral to send people back to this situation.
In this agreement signed between Turkey and the European Union earlier this month, your organization talks about the EU's courting of Turkey. What do you mean by that?
Well, the EU-Turkey refugee deal in itself is unlawful. You simply can't have a lawful plan where the fundamental part of it is blanket returns of refugees and asylum seekers. I mean, but what we've also seen is a knock-on effect. So when Turkey's been negotiating these series of deals with the EU, we've seen the situation in many ways get worse for refugees and asylum seekers in the country. So we've seen last year unlawful detentions of Syrian and also Iraqi refugees and asylum seekers. So people held in detention without access to their family members, without access to lawyers, and some of those people pushed back to Syria ahead of this latest series of mass returns that we've documented. So in a sense, it's Turkey learning from the EU, and what we're seeing is the construction first of Fortress Europe, but now Fortress Turkey, where it's incredibly difficult and dangerous to cross the border. People face illegal pushbacks, and Turkey really closing the border to new arrivals of refugees. There are already a huge number of refugees in Turkey, some 2.7 million Syrian refugees alone. So really the solution needs to be for the EU and other rich states to share the responsibility for accommodating these refugees, and for Turkey certainly to keep its border open to refugees, and for these refugees who are already in Turkey and those people who need to come into Turkey, for this responsibility to be shared between Turkey, between the EU, and other states who should be taking responsibility for resettlement.
Amnesty International's Turkey researcher Andrew Gardner, he's speaking from Istanbul. Well, the latest U.S. unemployment figures are out, and here for the details is Jill Malandrino, who joins us from New York. Jill, what does the data show?
The data showing that the unemployment rate actually moved to 5% from 4.9%, and 215,000 jobs were created. In addition, wage growth was up by 0.3%. And out of all those numbers, what analysts and traders look for is the wage growth itself, because that implies more consumer spending. It implies better jobs were created. We saw the market sell off before it opened in the futures market, because when we're seeing that employment growth has been healthy, we've had over 70 months of employment growth, it could possibly mean that the Federal Reserve might tweak their monetary policy. Perhaps they will take this as a good data point, and there might be an interest rate hike in the future. They could tighten monetary policy. And the reason why we saw a sell-off in the market was, as monetary policy, even the threat of it to tighten, means that they won't support asset prices such as stocks. Like, it has been very accommodative over the past couple of years. So that's why we saw that sell-off. But looking at it from a pure piece of economic data, to see that we're that consistent job growth is there, wage growth is increasing in a global slowdown growth environment, it was actually a really positive piece of data when you isolate it from that perspective.
Well, which sectors are growing and which are declining?
Well, you're always going to see the growth in services such as technology and healthcare, other sectors that are declining, anything that's based on goods such as infrastructure, construction, that sort of sectors in the marketplace. But anything that's service related, small business growth is another piece of data that we look at, and that will be coming out next week. And we're also getting the JOLTS, J-O-L-T-S jobs report, even though it lags the employment report that we saw today. There's more data in it, such as job openings, hiring, separations, firings. It has more detailed data. So that comes out next Tuesday, and certainly analysts will be looking for that as well, because that will certainly move the needle in terms of S&P 500 action.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Jill. That's Jill Malandrino from New York. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. The world's most famous female architect, 65-year-old Baghdad native Zaha Hadid, whose groundbreaking designs included the Aquatic Center for the London 2012 Games and a stadium for the 2022 Qatar World Cup, has died in Miami. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with architect Thomas Leslie. He's the Pickard Chilton Professor in Architecture at Iowa State University, and he spoke about Hadid's contributions to architecture and humanity.
She was she came out of a background in painting, and I think really offered a kind of freedom or the idea of a freedom for architectural form and architectural meaning that was very, very new, especially in the 1980s. I think also you can't underestimate the fact that she was a very strong female figure in a field that that needs those. And she was also, I think, one of the architects who really showed how architecture can be an important part of sort of international marketing, international branding, that architecture is a way for countries and corporations to make statements about their outlook was increasingly important at the end of last century, the beginning of this one.
She is known for the Italian National Museum of 21st Century Art in Rome, the Rosenthal Center for Contemporary Art in Cincinnati, and even the Guangzhou Opera House in China. She also was a winner of the Pritzker Architecture Prize. Now, what exactly is that?
Well, the Pritzker is often referred to as architecture's Nobel Prize. It's given annually to a living architect who has been the most influential over the past generation, who the committee feels has really set the agenda. And it was a remarkable moment when she won. She was the first woman to win, and it seemed long overdue at the time when she received it.
And she also was a teacher. She was handing on her knowledge to other people as well. Isn't that correct?
That's true. She taught extensively, and I think that, in addition to the buildings, that's certainly one of her most powerful legacies. Her students, of course, went on to great things, many of them in the vein of the kind of exuberant formalism that she was known for, many, I think, also slightly in rebellion against that. But I think as a student, it always helps to have a strong figure that you can either work with or you can work against in your career. And she was very powerful in that sense.
And her designs speak beyond their years as well. Looking at the Aquatic Center in London and some of her other designs, she broke some barriers, and people are probably going to be studying her work for years, right?
That's absolutely the case. Her work was, as I said, exuberant and often at odds with structural or constructional, what we might have regarded as structural or constructional truths, also occasionally at odds with the context, usually in ways that were provocative and interesting, sometimes in ways that drew controversy, but always in ways that grabbed attention, both for the architecture and for the spaces around them. And I think the power of her forms, as I said, was often at odds with some of the things that architects and sometimes urban planners hold dear. And that, I think, you know, her legacy will be as someone who poked and prodded at things that we took for granted for generations. Her work will absolutely be studied years into the future, both for what it promised and also, I think, what it rebelled against.
That's Thomas Leslie. He's a professor of architecture at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. He was speaking, of course, about the late Zaha Hadid, and he spoke with International Edition's David Byrd. That's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Like many other countries in the world, Bangladesh faces the threat of violent extremism. In Bangladesh, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell, said groups like Jamaat-ul-Mujahideen Bangladesh have long targeted innocent people in movie theaters, political gatherings, and New Year's celebrations. Recently, extremists stabbed a man to death in Kurigram because he converted to a new faith. This follows recent attacks against Shia Muslims, Hindus, and Christians. In the last few years, four bloggers have been murdered in cold blood. Bloggers like Avijit Roy, who was hacked to death at a book fair right here in Dhaka. These barbaric acts are not just attacks on the Bangladeshi people, but also their long tradition of open debate, religious tolerance, and moderation. Governments have an important role to play beyond deploying armies and police to protect people from extremist threats. Governments must govern justly and not use the fight against terrorism to undermine democracy and the rule of law by allowing detentions, excessive force, or restrictions on political space. These kinds of actions can actually drive people toward extremism, said Undersecretary Sewell. But governments cannot do it alone. Countering violent extremism requires empowering people, including religious leaders, women, businesses, and young people. But in order to unleash the talents of individuals in the fight against violent extremism, freedom of speech must be protected. As Undersecretary Sewell said, this includes protecting their fundamental freedoms to peacefully speak out, practice their faith or not practice one, and to organize on behalf of their beliefs. These are universal human rights, but they are also sources of resilience against violent extremism. When people are free to speak without reprisal about corruption or abuse by local police forces or feelings of marginalization, they can alert governments to address potential dangers of radicalization before they grow. In the face of violent extremism, said Undersecretary Sewell, I have no doubt that the people of Bangladesh will prevail if they stay true to their deepest traditions of inclusion, democracy, and trusting in the power of people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.